This is our home stretch panel. You guys better be so entertaining. Yeah. I'm just saying. I'm not putting any pressure on you. You've been in a rock band?
No.
Nice. All right. So this is the home stretch panel on conservation and mitigation policies as we move through this day. So, you guys ready?
I don't know how I can be entertaining when my nickname at home is Eeyore. Can
you call home and ask for help or something? I don't know. So, Lauren Clark, is everybody who works for a public, like lands, have hats in their photos? Is that like a requirement? Okay. So, Lauren Clark is the Assistant Director of the Community Development Resource Agency, and he is from Placer County. I can read, I know that. Robert Puro is the co-founder and CEO of Seedstock, Grow Riverside. You should be doing Seedstock in Fresno County, but we'll talk about that later. Robert C. is with USDA Rural Development. Robert came here, I think, as part of the Strong Cities, Strong Community work, so thank you for all that you have done here. I think that's it. So, Eeyore, take it away.
Truth be told, my wife was Eeyore when she worked at Disneyland, and then it kind of stuck on me over time once I became a bureaucrat. So I get the 3:30 gig after I see the caffeine dispensers also run dry, so we'll see what we can do. What I want to talk about today is really two things that were touched on earlier with the comments by Steve Frisch and Supervisor Weigand. One is the Placer Legacy Program, which is an open space and agricultural conservation program that implements our general plan. And the other is the Placer County Conservation Plan, which is also about open space and ag land, but it's a regulatory program. And one implements the other, and they sort of cross-pollinate. Talk a little bit about what we're trying to achieve and how we engage the public over time. What's the most important thing I can deliver today in terms of where these programs have come from and where they're going is the relationship with the general plan. Placer Legacy is a very successful program. It was awarded a leadership award by the governor a number of years ago. We don't get a lot done on the ground because we have relatively modest resources. But given who we are and what we are as a county, 350,000 persons, relatively small in size, 900,000 acres, we still manage to do a lot with what we have. We don't have regular funding. It's sort of an ad hoc approach in many respects. But what's important is we're grounded in policy, we're grounded in the community, we're grounded in community consensus, and that gives us the ability to move forward even with the limitations that we have on the resources. A lot of that happened in 1994. It was affirmed again in 2013 when we updated our general plan, but it really is the foundation upon which everything we've done is built. So Placer Legacy itself is a non-regulatory program that implements the open space goals and policies of our general plan, simply put. And we have been implementing it now since June of 2000. So we look at land from a variety of objectives in terms of conservation, and we seek to implement some of the goals and policies in the general plan. It isn't all just about land acquisition, it's even about the ag economy. It's about a scenic resource that maybe is conserved through the development of standards. So it's a variety of ways that we come at the resource. The Placer County Conservation Plan is dedicated to solving regulatory issues predominantly in western Placer County, where 90% of the growth is likely to occur over the next 50 years. So first I'm going to talk about Placer Legacy. These are the primary program goals. Maintain a viable agricultural segment of the economy. It doesn't say ag land, it says ag economy. Maintaining that has a connection to the land, obviously, but there's other things that we can do to ensure viability. Outdoor recreation, what we're looking at here is things beyond the standard soccer fields and ball fields. How does our community want to engage the open environment in terms of outdoor recreation? A couple of objectives on biodiversity, separation of urban areas, ensuring public safety, floodplains are open space. And lastly, to retain important scenic and historic areas. In terms of program development, it happened relatively quickly. A policy was done in 1994 with the general plan. 1998, we started a community dialogue, and by June of 2000, we were actually in the implementation phase and have been so ever since. One of the reasons why it was successful was public-private partnerships. We worked with the Sierra Business Council. The Sierra Business Council had NGO relationships with funding. We brought our own funding together. And sort of the power of the public and private coming together was very important in terms of our ability to move this engaging the community over and over and over again, both in the Citizens Advisory Committee, but also through public workshops. The last bullet point is pretty important. We had exceptional community engagement in an era when you couldn't get on Facebook, you couldn't get on Twitter, you couldn't even get on the internet to talk to people. So it was the phone, it was by foot, it was by person, it was one-on-one communication in many respects, real fast, real hard over that 2 years. We also had a lot of targeted outreach. The agricultural community may come to our stakeholder meetings and even be active members of that stakeholder committee, but when it came to talking about their issues, that was not their place. We had to go to them, we had to spend time with them, we heard their issues there, we brought those back into the larger stakeholder dialogue. We also had, as was said earlier, the presence of a science advisory group, as well as a lot of interaction with the wildlife agencies, at that time in a non-regulatory context. And then that second bullet from the bottom is most important. You have to have program champions. Supervisor Wigand has been dedicated to this program since he was on the Planning Commission in 1994 and during his entire tenure on the board. But it isn't just there. It's champions throughout the community in both the public and the private sector. We have about 5 program areas that were involved in Legacy. One is nested within those objectives is the regulatory piece. So when we talk about protecting biodiversity, it does have a regulatory component to it. We're preparing an HCP and an NCCP. We also do a lot of watershed level planning, setting aside the political boundaries and starting to look at Western Placer County and other areas as ecosystems that are functioning that pass in and out of political jurisdictions. Public outreach and education, we do acquire land, both fee title land, particularly if we're going to have a recreational component, as well as conservation easements. And then increasingly, the theme of opportunity for outdoor recreation on these Placer Legacy properties is a constant. We have spent $21 million overall in terms of implementation, $11 million of which has come from outside funding. So we're about one for one in terms of a public dollar committed from the county with a public dollar found in the public and private sector. We did pursue a quarter-cent sales tax shortly after the plan was implemented in June of 2000. 2 measures, B and W. One was a general tax increase, but needed a simple majority to be passed. We got 26%. The advisory measure, which would have said how we could spend the money, did pass. Because the general tax measure didn't pass, the funding obviously is not available. But that wasn't the end. Shortly after that, because we were so grounded in both the board politically and in the community, the board of supervisors started to set aside what they could in terms of discretionary spending into an open space trust fund account. You know, we've lived off of those revenues for the 14 years. A lot of success through state propositions, going back to Prop 204 and all the way through to Prop 84 today. And what we have found is whenever we put a program forward, we follow through on a commitment primarily to the state, and we deliver something, usually on the ground. They get to like you, and the more they like you, the more they like to fund your programs. So when they can get out there and walk around and say, we helped fund this, they get to report that back to the legislature. They get to point to that. Their programs are successful, and as a consequence, we're successful. We've also done well with gifts and donations. Once people understood who and what we were as a county program, and they started to trust us, monies and lands came in simply as gifts. 9,200 acres overall between us and our partners, which is primarily land trust, Placer Land Trust on the west, Truckee Darnell Land Trust on the east, a lot of work with the Trust for Public Land as well as state conservancies. We have 2 in our county. Just an example, it's sort of the most charismatic example, the one we're certainly the most proud of because it's the one where the community engages the most, is the Hidden Falls Regional Park. 1,200 acres in size, 3 miles of a perennial stream, salmon and steelhead, waterfalls on the property, open sunrise to sunset, no fee. People can just simply come and recreate on this property. Not paid for with Quimbiac. So this was not money being spent as mitigation. This was over and above because it was a Placer Legacy community value. We just opened up the second phase, which was 960 acres in size. This property will ultimately connect to 5,000 acres of land that we have secured through conservation easements and fee title. So the Hidden Falls property, and here, 1,200 acres in size, we have now secured over 10 and 11 properties, 3 miles of access to the Bear River, which is an east-west river coming out of the Sierra Nevada. this particular instance, it was persistence that paid off. It took years to assemble all those lands. It took years to find the funds and work with those partners. But we now have one of the largest networked areas in terms of public access anywhere in the Sierra Nevada at the local level. It's not also about just restoring land, it's also or buying land, it's also about restoring land. We have salmon and steelhead in three watersheds in our county. We worked very closely with both another local agency, the City of Lincoln, a special district, the Nevada Irrigation District, two federal agencies, three federal agencies, and two state agencies to open up fish passage on one of these streams, and it worked. The very next year, we had salmon and steelhead that had not been present in the upper reaches of this particular stream for well over 25 years. Overall, we're a very diverse county. You can see Lake Tahoe on the east and the Valley of the Floor on the west. 58% of all natural communities present in the state of California, includes the desert and marine, is present in Placer County because we have this cross section of the Sierra Nevada. You can also see that we're pretty shrewd politically. We managed to do a Placer legacy acquisition or deal in at least every supervisorial district. Make sure that board member has something to talk about in terms of the success of the program. Moving over to the Placer County Conservation Plan. So Placer Legacy General Plan talks about open space, talks about biodiversity, talks about species. It has a relationship to at least 16 species in our county that are listed under the state and federal endangered species acts. These are all in western Placer County, which is the yellow portion on this map. We have got similar efforts in Yuba and Sutter, Yolo County, and South Sacramento as well. This is where our growth occurs. This is where we have the interaction between endangered species and wetland regulations and our economic development goals and our general plan goals. So we're talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 areas of regulatory oversight, either at the local, state, or federal level. Our objective is to implement a plan, the Placer County Conservation Plan, conservation strategy, reach an agreement about that plan over 50 years. So the state and federal government will empower us to implement that plan on their behalf, providing streamlining, providing a one-stop shop. When a decision is made on entitlement, there's not a subsequent decision that's being made on a wetland fill permit under 404 or an incidental take permit. It's a single decision under the single conservation strategy. It's the county and the city of Lincoln to grow the shifting away from Roseville and Rockland area into the unincorporated area of the city of Lincoln. That's where the growth is going. So that's where the primary issues are with endangered species. We also have some major infrastructure that we're dealing with as well. Different program development. It's not as stakeholder based. The wildlife agencies, it's their set of rules that you're working with. It's their set of regulations that they are going to, in some respects, hand off to you, so they are very present in the dialogue. There is stakeholder engagement, but it not at the same level as they were at the Placer Legacy, more of a community-based approach, because the wildlife agencies, in the end, have to make findings in order for you to proceed. Also, what's key here is we have an ad hoc committee that's comprised of two electeds from the County of Placer, two electeds from the City of Lincoln, so they sort out the policy issues. Has been essential to this work program. A good part of the 14 years, 7 years, was spent inside that ad hoc dialogue with the community working out their joint objectives before we took a strategy to the wildlife agencies. Lots of public workshops, lots of dialogue with our board supervisors. Once again, targeted discussion with certain elements of the community. It was one thing to challenge the environmental community to come to the table about an open space program. When you start talking about their ag lands, as functioning biological ecosystem lands, it's another dialogue altogether. So it's very, very critical in this particular case that we spend time with the ag folks. In the end, we're dealing with this map. Yellow is where we have grown and will continue to grow. Dark green is 16,000 acres that's in conservation today. Sort of the dark blue is lands in the floodplain that will go into conservation, and then that lighter shade of green is the area within which we will build a 48,000 acre reserve system. It's about one-fifth of the western Placer landscape. 16,000 acres, the dark green, is in conservation today. In terms of how it's paid for, it's roughly a 60-40, 70-30 split. The numbers are being worked out between local government paying primarily through mitigation fees and state and federal government paying for conservation. So we pay to mitigate about 70% of the costs. They pay to conserve, which is making it better. So They bring money to the table to actually make the landscape better. They help restore, they help conserve, they help improve the environment beyond direct mitigation. Implementation costs you see in the top column, it is 90. It's a $1 billion program. It's a 50-year permit term. It will cost around $3 million a year in perpetuity at the end of the permit term. So we are obligated to sustain these lands forever at the cost of roughly $3 to $3.5 million a year, and endowment will fund that at year 50. So at the end, we'll have 48,000 acres of additional land going into conservation. We will have a conservation strategy that once and for all settles where we grow versus where we conserve. We will have local control over a lot of the permit activity. 404 permits will be issued at our front counter for small Clean Water Act fills. And we will also, on the economic development side, see 153,000 households and 90,000 new jobs within the permit area. And then lastly, in this simple slide, the wildlife agencies move from a regulatory role, where normally they would have the permit authority. They are now simply monitoring the activities of local government and ensuring that this future joint powers authority is appropriately implementing the plan over 50 years. Any other questions?
Thank you, Lauren.
All right. Thank you. So the program that I'm going to speak about today is called Grow Riverside, and it's a conference that my company Seedstock put together with the City of Riverside that focused on engaging the community and its major stakeholders to explore solutions to preserve and reinvigorate a unique agriculture zone in the city called the Green Belt. And it started with the Green Belt and then it expanded to the entirety of the city and just agriculture's importance to Riverside. So the program's currently ongoing. Before I go into it, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my company because I'm not a planner. I don't work for a government agency or a university. So,
and you'll be moving your business to Fresno County soon, but go ahead.
I will. I do like driving all over California. I drive to Riverside a lot. I'm in Los Angeles. I drive to Riverside everywhere. I have a lot of miles being put on. So my company, we are essentially a media and events company, and we're a social venture, and we foster sustainability and innovation in agriculture. So we do that through our website. Oops, I forgot to click. Through our website, seedstock.com, which you can see on the far right there, where we produce original content about farmers using sustainable practices, innovative business models, and it's all really about looking at the economic viability of sustainability, not so much from the activist perspective, because we want to sort of get as many people involved as possible, and I think that's why the City of Riverside came to us, because we were an apolitical body, and they could use us to help unify their community members. So, and as you can see, we've got a conference upcoming, shameless plug here, called Reintegrating Agriculture, Local Food Systems in the Future of Cities, which will explore how city and county policy can encourage investment in and support of local and urban agriculture, and that will be at UCLA Anderson School of Management on November 11th and 12th. And now to the Grow Riverside program. So this area here in the outline is the Green Belt. And it is 4,700 acres of zoned ag land. And it's protected by Prop C and Measure R, two downzoning measures that were passed in the late 70s and early 80s to protect the land from overdevelopment and also preserve the ag land. And in Riverside, in the city of Riverside, ag land currently accounts for about 11% of the land and the total acreage in the city, which is unique for a Southern California city. And just for some background, the Green Belt used to be primarily citrus, and the city of Riverside was the birthplace of the navel orange in California. And the city still maintains about 1,000 acres of citrus groves. So the problem is, for many in the Green Belt, the economics of citrus growing resulted in residents letting their groves go to seed. And so now there's brown land and white where once it was green. So the challenge that Riverside faces is how to turn this 4,700 acres of backland from brown to green and do so in a way that results in measurable benefit for the resident owners of the land, the surrounding community, and the local economy. Because there is some urgency here, and it's a little bit of a long-term urgency, but these propositions and measures can be overturned, and this land could be parceled up and developed, and then the island disappears and it ends up like Orange County. So there's that pressure. So just to sort of discuss how this rolled out, I think there was a call for action to ensure the preservation of the Greenbelt by Councilmember MacArthur, Ward 5, and former Mayor Ron Lovridge in July of 2013. And my company was brought in to help the city communicate the value of this land to residents and really get residents involved. And so we came up with this idea called Grow Riverside, Citrus and Beyond. And we say Citrus and Beyond because citrus is not that it's looking at what else can be economically viable in terms of a crop grown in the city or crops. So the conference was designed to be an outcomes-based conference to help the city reconnect to its agricultural roots and galvanize citizens, growers, advocates, government officials, other major stakeholders around the economic opportunities that can result from embracing sustainable and local agriculture solutions. So to get things going, we worked with the city to reach out to the community to assemble a group of stakeholders from across the spectrum, from growers to council members and business owners to school garden advocates to Riverside Public Utility, the cooperative extension specialists, and to what Mr. Frisch said earlier, was a lot of one-on-one engagement because the person who initiated, the people who initiated this program were from a certain part of the political spectrum and there were other people from other parts of the political spectrum, so it was really uniting them around this idea of the economic opportunity that could be gained from activating this land. So we held a meeting with these stakeholders to determine the goals and objectives and get their buy-in. And the meetings were really well attended. We get about, I think, 30 to 40 people at each meeting. We continue these meetings because we're doing Grow Riverside again in spring. I think we had 50 people last week at the meeting. It's the middle of August, so it's pretty impressive. The community is very, very engaged. And so within our initial meetings, looking at Riverside's landscape with the stakeholders and the growing demand for local food, a decision was made to focus the conference and communication efforts on the following goals. To define the opportunity for local food production and agriculture in the city, and then to explore solutions to increase the local food in the city in a sustainable and economically viable manner. And then three, to come up with practical next steps to enable the city to leverage its rich agricultural roots. So in terms of involving the stakeholders, we had them sign up for committees to help solicit wider community involvement. So we have like a local marketing committee, sales and sponsorship committee, and coordination. Everyone was very actively engaged and involved. And we created, so this is sort of an example of some of the stakeholders who were mostly university participants. We had private business, we had the school district, we had the Department of Public Health. And so we created branding for the event, developed the conference narrative and program, and solicited speakers and panelists to discuss solutions to problems the Riverside was facing. The conference took place at the Riverside Convention Center on March 19th and 20th of this year, so it was a really quick turnaround time from July of 2013 to March 19th and 20th. We brought in experts to discuss such topics as the development of regional and local food policy, transfer of development rights, economics of local food marketplace. Also, there's a lot of citrus in Riverside, so we had experts come in and talk about HLB and facility. We also had people come in and talk about the benefits of the farming school program and how the area farmers could sell into the program and have a new market. We also set up a website where resources were listed and the conference was promoted and outlined. We used social media extensively. The conference was streamed online and it's archived on YouTube, so you can go and watch the proceedings if you want. The community also got involved a lot. And just in terms of outcomes, yeah, some of this is sort of self-serving media impressions. So there was a wide exposure. We had a sellout audience of over 420 people. We had no idea we were going to get this many people. We literally promoted this in 3 months. So it's a great turnout, and we got wide participation from private businesses in the city and businesses outside of the city, like Denifin, Whole Foods. So we had 54 sponsors, and they covered most of the costs associated with the event, which was funded by the city. So there was also generation of new business leads for the city of Riverside. There's an understanding that in the city, they have artesian wells and water seeps, and there were farmers who came to the conference and they saw how the city was really working to agriculture. And so there are some farmers that want to move to the city. There's a hydroponic growing company based in San Diego that's looking to open operations there more. And then I think what was really the big piece is just the momentum that the conference created. So they're currently in the process of forming the Food Policy Council. There are new positions that have been created in the Economic Development Office and within the city focused on local food and agriculture, and just increased community involvement and engagement. Really everybody's sort of united around figuring out how to preserve this land and how to keep agriculture in Riverside and make it an economic driver.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. All right, this is the cleanup hitter, or not a baseball player, whatever that's called. You're the last one. Let's just go with that.
Okay. Well, at least I'm not standing between you and dinner.
Right? Not quite.
Or speaking during dinner. That's happened too. That's the tough part. Well, my name's Robert Seam with USDA Rural Development, and as it was mentioned, I'm actually pretty familiar with Fresno because I've been the USDA lead for the Strong City, Strong Communities effort in directly with the city of Fresno. What I brought in, actually, was a focus on agriculture in the region. And it's important because it's discussion earlier, and Steve talked about collaboration, and the 12 federal departments that collaborated in Fresno, all the other 11 were very focused, they're urban-focused agencies. You have HUD, you have EPA, which is really focused on the urban side for Fresno. Department of Transportation, again, was focused on the urban side. I would say my contribution to that is to convince them that you have to take a regional approach. You already have the region in Fresno County, but I look at it even more broadly. Because the problems don't stop at the border of any jurisdiction. Don't fall into jurisdictional silos, whether it's geographic or subject matter. It's a lesson learned from that. But the other two perspectives, and you're gonna get a feel for that as I go in, is that I've also worked with the California Economic Summit, and some people were seeing each other again and again in meetings. They had their capital meeting just last week, and that is another opportunity to change policy at the state level, which will benefit you as well. So I'll get into that. So first of all, I think I'll follow the SE2 success legacy. Is first you got to know where you sit. What's the legacy? What's the global view of that? San Joaquin Valley, $30 billion farm gate, largest ag region in the U.S. Fresno County alone is nearly $7 billion in farm gate. Fresno County is the largest ag producing county in the United States, bigger than any single county in Texas or Iowa, the number two and three states in agriculture. Not only that, but the valley, and I put the valley numbers in there because Fresno is dead center of the San Joaquin Valley, so you have to integrate the whole. And this is relevant for the transportation group in terms of goods movement. $9 billion in ag exports from the San Joaquin Valley, and probably $2 to $3 billion from Fresno County alone. Those are going out in exports. They're going to go out either directly south to Mexico, or to the port of L.A. Long Beach, or to the port of Oakland, or through the port of Stockton. You have to figure out how it gets there. And I know the San Joaquin Valley COGS had a goods transportation study done over the last 2 years. It's a piece of that. The other thing is you want to look at is what's going on, the big disruptive event that changes things. You're dead center of that as well, the drought in California, which we expect to continue probably for a few more years. So what is that? That alone on conservation is going to have a major impact of what people do on conservation, whether you interpret conservation as conservation of water as a farmer, or conservation of water in the urban areas, or conservation on different landscapes. So if you go from that, that's going to take you to technology. I think it's already a driver here, but I would say going from the drought, and I'll just focus, there's five different major areas where there's new developments in ag technology that are being applied here in Fresno and in California. But I'll just pick on the one on water as the key one because of the drought impact. And the conservation side of that, see, okay, here, if you just want to look at the different new ag technologies, variable rate irrigation, drip irrigation, wireless soil sensors, which are tied to the irrigation, and multispectral imagery using ag drones, which help manage the conditions of crops. This is all new technologies. This technology, it's an enabler for farmers for conservation. On the environmental side, if you look at it exclusively at that, it's going to shrink the environmental footprint of agriculture at the same time as technology allows for increases in yield and production. So it's actually a win-win across the board. The drought may be a catalyst to drive things because it makes it a necessity. But what do all those things have in common? What they have in common, actually, is the underlying technology that drives it, which is wireless broadband. You have to have wireless broadband for any of that technology to work because basically it transmits data. So basically, and that slide captured that, in terms of the new frontier of ag technology, that it runs off of wireless broadband, which is in the farm field. Nobody's really thought about that aspect. To the extent you hear about discussions of cell phones and service, it's actually in the cities, or people complain you drive down I-5 and your cell phone drops. You have that piece. But I would say, from our perspective and looking at it, rural wireless broadband is not only new ag technology, and I had those same different subsectors in there, and I won't go through all the other pieces, but this is a linking tie for all the other pieces of developing the rural economy, from telehealth, and you've heard some talk about that and those numbers that were given. If you want to improve those numbers, you need to take a look at rural telehealth. There's opportunity there, telehealth and telemedicine in rural areas, if you've got enough broadband. Same thing with distance learning, which gets you the jobs, transportation and logistics, public safety, market access, which part of that is transportation piece. And I would also toss in rural agritourism and recreation as well. So here is what actually we developed with the City of Fresno CIO office, is actually sort of a strategy look at a rural-urban broadband strategy, which I think is unique in the sense that most people, when they look at strategies, they're either only looking at urban or only looking at urban and not trying to integrate the two. But what's important for you to see here, actually, is this map. This map shows you what's served and underserved in terms of broadband signal in Fresno County. The green is served. This is underserved here. And then there's no service out there. It looks a little bit similar to some of those other maps you saw with the demographics, doesn't it?
What's the red?
The red is no service at all. Now, I will point out that this map overstates the service that's there because it's based off of the official maps, which overstate it, which is the information that comes from the telecoms. And the way they do it is it just overstates, because if you have a signal like in this corner here, the whole track is counted, whether it's served or not. You have the opportunity actually to change that because of this tool, CalSpeed, which was created by the California Public Utilities Commission. Basically what this tool is, it's an app. You can download it to your Android phone, and what it does is you go anywhere you go, you stop, you push the button, it will measure the download and upload speed and the delay and mark it by GPS location and automatically populate the official map over at CPUC. If you want to apply for a broadband grant from the California Emerging Technologies Fund, which they have $80 million from the legislature, which I think is the first round will be available at the end of December, it's the deadline, you have to demonstrate, because those funds are limited to unserved areas. You're going to have to document that. If the map, the official map doesn't back it up, send people out with those bones. Populate the map as part of establishing your basic part of being qualified for that. I'm actually literally right now working with West Hills Community College to get their ag students to go out and go into the farm fields, quite literally, with those bones. We're putting this project together. It's in being developed. But they would go out into the fields that, because they have all these ag students, and they're going to go out in the fields where they have sort of a co-op program, I would say, and actually measure the signal in the field, because nobody's measuring the signal in the field. And from what I've been told anecdotally by some producers and people over at the Farm Bureau, is that they have bought all this new ag equipment, that this irrigation equipment that can minimize the loss of water or maximum efficiency. But they can't install it because there's no wireless signal in some of the fields. So that's the biggest constraint. But they've already recognized the value of that. So this is a tool that's going to help make the case. So I throw this out as a tool. And the other tool, you've seen all these different maps before. This is the RUX model developed by SACOG. And some of you may have already heard of it. But this is a model developed by SACOG. It's an econometric model. It's not a static map. And basically what it does is you take all this data, you input it. It was designed really for looking at working landscapes, what we call working landscapes on the ag side, as a tool that you can run, because it's an econometric model, you can run the big benefit of this as opposed to a static map. It's an econometric model, you can run different scenarios. The what if question. So in Sacramento, because of the big crop is tomatoes. So I'll give you the examples from that. So you got a field of tomatoes. If you're trying to make a decision on, well, what's the real value of that field of tomatoes versus a large development? The traditional approach is you just look at property tax generated, in which case agriculture will always lose to a developer, because if you just match the property tax of the field versus any kind of development, it's going to generate more property tax. But that's kind of a false lead to that, because first, the tomato field itself, there's a whole economic chain, the value-added chain, from the farm workers to, if the tomatoes are then, in Sacramento's case, they go to the tomato processing facility in Woodland, the value of those canned tomatoes, and all the way into the export market. You capture all those dollars in the region, and it's more than just a field of tomatoes that has an impact. If that field disappears, that tomato factory in Woodland doesn't operate anymore. So you have a larger effect. It can also look at, if you look at development, what are all the costs of that? What are the inputs you got to put in to that? What's the impact on the roads? This model was originally developed to look at the impact on rural roads with development. So if you have more cars, then you have a whole change that's going to happen in terms of the infrastructure you've got to build, whether it's streets, lights, police protection, schools, additional costs. But this is a great tool. This is the tool at the California Economic Summit, the Working Landscape Group, that we actually pushed forward. That's what we see for California, because it was developed exclusively for California. The opportunity for you is this. SACOG is willing to make this open source. They probably put in over $800,000 at a minimum developing this model. They're in the process now of making it open source, and we're working with them to sort of help that along. If you had this tool, there's a whole range of things, and I only hit the highlights of that just to get the point across. But the thing to remember, it's an econometric model. It's ideal for looking at working landscapes. You can run the different scenarios, the what ifs, each one of these maps. The colors are different because it's actually showing different scenarios that were run. The other value to you is if you think of things like health, we discussed earlier, health data explicitly was not part of this model. This is more of an agriculture-focused model. But the way that model is, you can add health data to it in a RUX like 3.0. You could modify that, add that to it, and you get another look. And probably you already got the data because you've already seen it on a map. You took the health data, put it in here. You get another look. You could also take a look at the economic impact. then you get into the social equity issues that can't be dealt with. So I'll just finish there with that. Just leave this up. So thanks.
Thank you, Robert. That's awesome. Thank you to our three panelists very much. So let's do just a few minutes of Jeff. Why do I know you have questions?
This is my favorite panel.
So let's open up just a few minutes of questions, and we've got a revised plan B to get us to the end of our afternoon, and we'll get you out here before 5 o'clock. Jeff?
Two questions. First one's for Lauren. On the Placid Conservation Plan, when and if that goes into effect in a couple of years, will that exempt projects from doing additional CEQA work if they fit the plan?
It's not a question of if. It is now a question of when. It'll be about 2 years we should be in implementation, and we gain efficiencies under the California Environmental Quality Act by having program-level environmental documents done. Same with on the federal side as well.
Okay.
So there's a tiering benefit by virtue of having those issues evaluated at a landscape scale.
So it doesn't exempt you, but it can certainly give you a leg up.
Correct.
You're a developer.
And you're implementing one strategy for 50 years.
Right.
So you're not rethinking your mitigation strategy with every project.
Okay, I had one other question, and that's for the second speaker, Robert. Regarding the citrus grove, I didn't hear who owns that citrus grove property and if its owner would support it.
What's that?
If the owner of that property was supportive of keeping it as a citrus grove?
So the green belt is owned. It's all private residences. So they're primarily, I think, 5-acre parcels.
Oh.
And a lot of the owners of the groves they want to hold on to the citrus heritage. And maybe a few of them make a couple bucks. But typically they're just Sunkist comes in and does all the packaging.
So they were supportive of your effort?
Oh, yeah, they were very supportive. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think he's getting it. They don't want to become a subdivision themselves, and they see you coming along saying, no, stay agriculture. Question, please, in the back.
For Lauren, land that you put under conservation, did you buy the development rights from the owners?
It really does vary from deal to deal. Through the Placer Legacy Program, where we do work on a lot of working landscapes, as well as lands that are serving a variety of open space purposes, not always ag. The property owner often defines what their expectations are, sometimes to retain one or more development right for subsequent generations, versus what is the public objective in terms of conservation. There's been occasions where we couldn't reach an agreement. Our need for certain conservation objectives could not be matched by the property owner's interest in retaining development rights. In other examples, they've completely relinquished all development rights for adequate compensation. So the dollar amount of the compensation varies considerably, primarily on the issue of how many development rights are being retired.
And where did the funding come from to buy the development?
So roughly 50% of our funding overall has come from primarily state grants, and then 50% from local general fund revenues. We've also had a fair amount of land donated. Property owners make a gift or a partial gift for tax purposes. We've also had cash donations as well, and we've also done a lot of deals with the land trust where we have been a minority funding partner with the land trust cobbling together from a variety of interests funding to implement the deal. So in those instances, the government doesn't hold the conservation easement, the land trust does. We're just simply a funding partner.
Is it available on your website, the conservation plan?
Yeah, for both the Placer Legacy Program, there's information on the link on the PowerPoint.